the immigration system, right? This huge behemoth infrastructure network system of so many different organizations that it as it exists today was built by specific people. It had to be made and constructed.
Welcome to Indocu Talks. Bienvenidos. This is Elena and I'll be your host. This podcast is created by immigrant community for the immigrant community. We are committed to discussing important immigration topics surrounding news, culture, education, and art. Indocu Talks includes undergraduate, graduate, professors, and community collective members. Collectively, we are Indocu Scholars, which we define as individuals who are conducting research, writing, documenting, producing artwork, and developing public projects from the lived experiences of being undocumented, formerly undocumented, or children of immigrants. You are listening to episode 4 of our season 4 titled The Deportation Express. In the beginning of our program, you heard our guest author, Ethan Blue, with a significant statement on deportation. Rafa, you and our scriptwriter Melissa interviewed Ethan. Can you tell our community about him?
Hola, Lena. Yes, we did a Zoom interview with our guest today, Ethan Blue, who is a historian writing about the development of the modern-day system of deportation and its origins. But rather than introducing him, here he is introducing himself for our listeners and community members.
Yeah, I'm Ethan Blue. I'm a senior lecturer in history at the University of Western Australia. I was raised on Coast Miwok country on Turtle Island, also known as Northern California. And here I'm speaking from Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. And this is land where the Noongar people have never ceded sovereignty to Australians. And as I understand it, sovereignty really can't be ceded because the relationship between people and country is not like a fungible, tradable sort of thing. I acknowledge elders of this country, past and present, and that I am, as a settler invader, I've been benefiting from these lands many times over, and that's something that I'm really, really grateful for.
That was Ethan Blue talking about his positionality and where he's calling in from, but here he is expanding on his scholarly work.
In terms of my scholarship, my day job, I focus on teaching U.S. history. And my work kind of crosses in and out of the fields of critical carceral studies and critical prison studies, immigration history, histories of settler colonialism, and the histories of racial capitalism. And so my work really revolves around those different kinds of fields.
We wanted to get back to our storytelling origins of this podcast to share with you all the impact and importance of Ethan Blue's work as it relates to our immigrant communities.
I'm always ready for a good and important story. Where does this story begin?
Elena, that is a good question. Our last episode was on critical consciousness with Carlos Aguilar and Germán Cadenas. This episode aims at expanding our historical knowledge and connecting the modern-day deportation system to the evolving technologies across the centuries, including the telegraph and the train system, as a form of growing the state's ability to deport a growing immigrant population.
That sounds like important information, but also really sensitive and delicate information.
That is correct. We do want to provide a community warning that this episode contains graphic detail of violence, deportation practices, invasive medical practices, sexual violence, and gruesome archival descriptions. We recognize these details can prove challenging to some of our community members, and we make an effort to create an intentional pause to reflect, process, and choose to listen forward or walk away from this episode.
Thanks for the heads up. I know I need those pauses many of the times to process and think through challenging scenarios.
Agreed. We will take an audio break, and when we return, we will listen to the first story from Ethan's book titled The Deportation Express. Stay tuned.
Thank you. Rafa, you promised us a story, so where does this story begin?
To start our story, let's go back to the opening audio that you heard in today's episode.
The immigration system, right? This huge behemoth infrastructure, network, system of so many different organizations that it, as it exists today, was built by specific people. It had to be made and constructed.
Ethan talks about individuals who helped build the modern day immigration system. As such, he begins his book, The Deportation Express, with this figure called Henry Weiss. Who is he? Here is Ethan painting us a picture of the figure that Henry would go on to become.
The meat of the book starts off with Henry Weiss, in part because he's a really fascinating and, again, like a troubling character. So Weiss is born in Turkey. He moves to the United States, and he becomes a really central figure in the development of the deportation regime. Like, he speaks 7 different languages. He's enormously ambitious. He's enormously talented. He's enormously hardworking. And he finds he can get a job with the Immigration Bureau and work his way up. He winds up getting yanked around in the Bureau quite a bit. Like, there's no small ethnocentrism within the Immigration Department itself. And there's some evidence of that in the records that he bristles against. But nevertheless, he's super ambitious. He works his way up the system. And then, because, again, he's so hardworking and because he speaks 7 languages, the immigration authorities realize that he's going to be really good at running these deportation trains. He can manage the trains really well. And one of the things that I think that this shows, first of all, is that the immigration system, right, this huge behemoth infrastructure, network, system of so many different organizations that it, as it exists today, was built by specific people. It had to be made and constructed. One of the lessons that I think is important from this is that, kind of this is what I think is important about history, is you can see how these systems grow and develop and are built, which also suggests the opportunities for unbuilding these systems. These systems can be dismantled as well.
As I was reading the opening section of Ethan's book, all I kept thinking to myself was, why would an immigrant work for the immigration system aimed at deporting fellow immigrants? Through Ethan's archival work, his story illuminates the complex history of the immigration system and the individuals that helped construct it. Here he talks further about Weiss.
Through work, through human action, and through human labor, they're not inevitable. They were made by specific people who did specific things. And you can also see his motivations too, because you got to, you know, take him seriously as a person with his desires and opportunities and what he sees. He saw this as a good job. This was an opportunity for him and his family to get respect, a steady paycheck, a uniform. This is something that the United States as an empire has been really effective at in terms of using migrants and subordinated peoples, you know, structurally subordinated folks, bringing them in and then incorporating them in the process of colonization, settlement, and immigration restriction. And I think Weiss demonstrates a lot of these in really important ways.
Henry sounds like quite an interesting character.
So I start off the book with Weiss because Weiss and the other immigrant agents who follow in his tracks.
Yep. And Henry is only the beginning.
Again, to show how it's being built, but also to have a really people-centered story, because I'm interested in talking about the ways that the system develops as a system, as an infrastructure, or as a racializing assemblage, to use more, you know, academic language about it. I'm more interested in the human-centered elements of it.
So how did Ethan find and get inspired to share all of these stories?
Well, Naturally, as a historian, Ethan points to his beginnings at the archives, the old papers. In his next clip, he speaks about how the initial research led him to find records connecting him to deportation. Let's take a listen.
I went to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and then a handful of other regional archives, and I found some of the earliest itineraries of the deportation trains. These were itineraries that were sent from the Immigration Bureau to Weiss. And so saying, hey, you know, Henry, you're going to go pick up this person here, pick up this person there, pick up this person there. And it would have each of their case file numbers. And the case files were, of course, these are, you know, collections of documents developed to build a case to kick somebody out, right? And so they're very partial, they're very contained, they're very much from the state-centered, state's perspective. But nevertheless, these are the documents that still exist. I read many, many hundreds of these case files, and I then reconstructed the passenger lists of some of the earliest trains from those case files, and tried to reconstruct people's life stories as best I could, and to trace their journeys through global racial capitalism, the conditions that drove them to leave County Cork in Ireland, that drove them to leave the Punjab, that drove them to leave Tampico, and then brought them into the conditions of their travel, the conditions of their life and their labor, and then the ways that they get swept into the American carceral welfare state. Each chapter is a stop on the train's journey.
All aboard!
That tells the experiences of folks who were loaded aboard the train at that stop.
The next train stop, chapters, and stories coming up next.
Before the train as this new technology and the telegraph as this new technology that we're working together. And so you can see how emergent technologies are used for kinds of carceral control and immigration control.
Welcome back. I'm Elena Calderon, and I'm the host of Undocu Talks. This is episode 4 of our season 4 titled The Deportation Express. As we came back from the musical break, you heard Ethan Blue, our guest, talk about the train system in the U.S. help grow the system of deportation. The importance of Ethan's book, as I see it, is connecting the modern-day immigration system with how it developed and unfolded in its infancy. As an example, a term that is thrown around in today's immigrant debate is public charge, to describe if an immigrant individual is able to quote-unquote pull their own weight in this country or if they're going to need state assistance. Rafa, you did a Zoom interview with Ethan. What kind of examples did he find with the use of this term in historical examples?
Yes, the next historical example is focused on the topic of public charge. The next stop of the Deportation Express train takes us to Rochester, New York, where Ethan tells us the story of John and Misty Lester.
We want to provide a trigger warning. Please feel free to take a pause if you feel the need or if the material can be too difficult to process.
John Lester and Minnie Lester. And they're from England. Minnie Lester is she's a single mom. Her husband has died in Birmingham, England. She comes and moves to Rochester with her child, John, and she moves in with her some family. John has what would today be called a cognitive difference or maybe a developmental disability. It's not entirely clear. I mean, just like likely to become a public charge is this hugely capacious category that basically anybody can be jammed into. At the same time, quote unquote, feeble-mindedness was a similar category. And so the four-year-old John was considered feeble-minded by welfare and immigration authorities. Minnie had a job. She was cleaning other people's houses. So she was doing domestic labor and reproductive labor so that other people could go out and work. And she was able to make ends meet on her own, but because John, her son, you know, had special needs, she couldn't leave him on his own. She sent him to the Rochester Industrial School, which was a school designed to train the next generation of immigrant youth to become either labor, you know, industrial or domestic workers in a really condescending way. The Rochester Industrial School one afternoon had her son tied up to a chair, which she was not happy about. She wound up applying for a mother's pension, I think, as I recall it was called, to get a little bit of support, $2 a week, to pay another woman to look after her son so she could go look after other people's houses and earn a living. Rochester Superintendent of Welfare did not believe that this immigrant woman, though being English, right, ostensibly white by these measures, because she was a single mom, because she had a special needs son, and given all of the very horrific eugenic categories of the day, these were folks on whom welfare money should not be spent, the guy believed, and that moreover, this was a child, according to eugenic ideologies, who should never have been born. And so the immigration authorities are contacted by the local welfare agents, and they agree, yep, he shouldn't have been let in the country, as likely become a public charge, the mom also, and so they then get loaded aboard the deportation special and removed from the country.
The story of John and Misty exemplifies the use of the category public charge. Next, Ethan outlines other connections to the immigration system that began as a design and the form of categorizing immigrants as unfit.
There were these new connections between the different branches of the carceral welfare state. And so new connections between like prison systems, new connections between mental institutions, workhouses, hospitals, and asylums. And so all of these various branches of the so-called carceral welfare state, right? And if folks have read Michel Foucault or Nicholas Rose or any of these kinds of sociologists, they know these institutions are designed to produce docile citizens, right? Finger quotation marks around that. They never do, but what they do with these new connections is they produce quote unquote undesirable aliens. And so there's this new apparatus of capture that is being developed through the technology of the train, through the technology of the telegraph, that can then go through all of these state institutions designed either to punish, control, discipline, or in some cases, quote unquote, help, newly coming together to then control people who have citizenship in these repressive institutions, or else to filter out people who are not considered citizens and who aren't even deserving of being in these quite horrible institutions. Right? So you've got this kind of abjection and this sort of control and this sort of insult that is being layered on folks who are then being called insane or being called criminal. The likely to become a public charge category, this is a category that actually goes back to like the 17th century, right? And the English poor laws. And so this was an element of immigration control from the very first stages of colonization in what becomes known as the Americas. But the whole idea is how to portion who gets relatively scarce social welfare funds and who doesn't. And if you don't, then you just get kicked out. And the likely to become a public charge category is one that then gets written and also rewritten and rewritten and rewritten into immigration law. And it's something that can be applied retroactively with new generations of immigration law that says, okay, even if you're already in the country, and then you are accused of being a quote unquote public charge, it's almost impossible to disprove that you were supposedly likely to become a public charge, you know, 3 years ago when you came in. But it serves this administrative role to legally justify removal.
It then connects these new legal categories in the immigration system to gender and sexuality in his analysis.
And one of the things this speaks to also is the way that gender and reproduction is so central here. because so much of immigration law has this kind of biopolitical, you know, to use our, you know, fancy academic language again, these biopolitical dimensions about who gets to have babies in the country and who doesn't. Biological population of the nation into the future. Who's going to be the most docile citizen? Who's going to be the most obedient subject? Who's going to make the most money for the business they work for? And all of these sorts of questions. And then this plays out too around ideas of so-called sexual morality and the white slave panics of the day too. And a number of the folks who I talk about here are accused of sexual immoralities in one way or another, either men who desire sex with other men in ways that are considered problematic, or sex workers, or people whose income is somehow derived in one way, shape, or form from sex work.
Stay tuned. The next stop in the Deportation Express train is coming up. Welcome back. We have been talking to our guest and author of the book, The Deportation Express, Dr. Ethan Blue. His book covers the development of the modern-day immigration system as it relates to emerging technologies. As a storytelling podcast, each segment has focused on a stop along the grueling journey of the modern-day immigration system. As a historian, we talked to Ethan about the process of conducting archival research and encountering such troubling documents. Here's part of the conversation that Ethan had with our scriptwriter, Melissa Garcia. Please feel free to take a pause if you feel the need or if the material can be too difficult to process.
For me, it's always really important to approach the archives and the past with a sense of profound humility and to try to, as best I can, imagine and respect the dignity of the people who whose lives I'm getting a brief glimpse into. That work can be, you know, like that work can be kind of heavy. These are situations where people are going through pretty horrible stuff. Just going back to the Leo Stanley papers, many years ago, I found a scrapbook that he kept of photos. These were images of prisoners with their pants pulled down when they probably didn't need to have their pants pulled down. These were situations of what might be called photographic rape in this prison context, in the interest of his medical, quote unquote, medical research. And he certainly had what would pass as an alibi, you know, for doing this research. But it is profoundly problematic and profoundly distressing. Just for me, as a researcher, I realized that I couldn't do this work at home, but I could only do this work in an office space. And to try to separate that sort of the emotional weight of that work from my home life, rather than in an office kind of space or a workspace. I mean, which is, of course, by no means to say that, you know, my suffering is equivalent to the people who I'm studying, whose lives I'm studying, or the conditions that they're subject to. But one of the things that I think is also important in the kind of work that I imagine myself doing is that these are indictments on the carceral state. You know, these are indictments on this deportation regime and on the situations of racial capitalism, of gendered racial capitalism and cis-heteropatriarchy and all of these interlocking, interwoven, intersecting systems. And so that's what kind of helps me through it and kind of motivates the work.
Thank you. You can't really see through Zoom, but I did get emotional because I connected with what you said as far as understanding your positionality, right? That I know for myself, I'll never go through what my parents went through, but it's important to remember like where we're coming from with that, what you mentioned with the humility and the dignity of those individuals. And then also something that I've been struggling with, like I can't work in my office sometimes. And part of it is the interview stuff, but then also like it feels at home, right? I can't work here in my house, in my office room, because it feels too close, I think, to my private space.
Ethan and Melissa's conversation remind us that the work we do is always personal. It affects us emotionally and mentally. I can only imagine encountering such materials in a library and being frozen, trying to process all the atrocities committed.
Ethan's element of storytelling in his book tells the collective stories, but also focuses and provides deep insights into individuals who built the modern-day immigration system. Leo Stanley is one of those figures in Blue's book. With the nickname The Butcher, Leo Stanley is a character that can very well fit into the modern-day TV show American Horror Story.
Again, as we move into this next story, we want to provide a trigger warning that the next passage involves depictions and descriptions of corporal punishment. Please feel free to take a pause if you feel the need or if the material can be too difficult to process.
Yeah, Leo Stanley, again, just a fascinating, profoundly troubling person. Just to bring it back to that photo album, when I read that, I came across that photo album, and then I was reminded of like the line from Walter Benjamin, where he says in his thesis on the philosophy of history, "There is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. And just as such a document is not free of barbarism, barbarism also taints the manner in which it was transmitted from one owner to another." Here we've got this guy who's a doctor in prison. And it's worth pointing out, he's in California, where medicine, where prison medicine is much more sophisticated than it is, you know, across the Deep South, for example. So where people are just brutalized, you know, denied very basic medical conditions. I think one of the things that you can do is you can look at Stanley's photo album and you can look at his work and see how his sorts of medical, quote unquote, care was brutalizing and awful, but it was also related, it was different then, but related to the kind of lynch mobs that were going on across the South, right? And so just like Leo Stanley had his photo album of medical care, in finger quotation marks, in the South, there were the necropolitical, violent lynch mob photos being taken. Right. And so these are two poles on a similar spectrum of modern American racially gendered power, and the biopolitical medicalized one versus the necropolitical brutal, bloody and murderous kinds of violence.
Ethan uses the term biopolitics and necropolitics in describing that really, truly horrific story. And again, we know this material can be very triggering and also very difficult to process. So if you need to take a break, please, this might be a good moment to take a break after listening to very heavy content. For the next section, we're going to talk a little bit about biopolitics. So you might be asking yourself, what does biopolitics refer to? Well, it means when the state or country manages life. So what do I mean by that? For example, through the institution of the law of a country, the state determines who may be fit to be in a society versus who is not. Through the institution of prison or the carceral system, those who are deemed to not be a part of society can be imprisoned. That is what we refer to as biopolitics, where the state manages lives. On the other hand, necropolitics refers to state violence and death as a way of managing who is not fit to be part of that country. Here is Ethan breaking it down further as it relates to his book. Escuchemos.
Or one of the arguments I make, at least, with the development of the deportation train and the deportation system is a historical shift where, you know, if you've got biopolitics and necropolitics, sort of biological control of life versus the murderous control through death as being two parts of a spectrum. In the 19th century, a lot of anti-immigrant control was necropolitical, right? It was like the murderous rampages against Chinese in California, anti-Mexican violence along the border from the Texas Rangers. And so you've got this necropolitical bloody violence in the late 19th century, which then gets sort of contained and transformed into the sort of spatial control and spatial rearrangement of bodies in biopolitics and in the deportation system. If you think about the different, you know, the other example of deportation trains that mostly comes to mind is the Nazis. The Nazis were a straight up murderous necropolitical regime about murderous violence, whereas the American deportation regime that's developed isn't necessarily gonna kill people. It just says you can't live here. So it doesn't have that kind of open, naked murderousness. It's a different way of accomplishing the same ends. Which isn't to say, of course, that there isn't that capacity for murderous violence within the modern American immigration and deportation and carceral state, because there is, and that's ongoing. But that gets sort of sublimated within the more biopolitical systems that emerged throughout the 20th century. So it's a different kind of management. And it's arguably the US has what, deported 56, 57 million people since the 1890s. So it's arguably a more stable, sustainable system of control than the more nakedly murderous one.
In this episode, we have been talking about the history of deportation with our guest and historian, Ethan Blue, author of the book, The Deportation Express. For our next segment, the train's next stop takes us to the Northwest, to Portland, Oregon.
One sex worker is wholly unrepentant about being a sex worker when she's interviewed. And when she's busted by immigration authorities, she's, you know, it's like, this is how she makes a living. And so this flies in the face of ideas about what heteropatriarchal sexual moralities are. There's no indication that she had been coerced into sex work at all. In the situations where there is evidence of women being coerced into sex work, immigration and they're women of color, that is, along the border, immigration authorities do not seem particularly concerned about this. In this particular case, Germaine Monet, she's in Portland, Oregon. She's pretty unrepentant about it. And she, in fact, winds up tricking the immigration authorities who investigates her. She says she is from Belgium. The First World War has just broken out, and so they can't deport her to Belgium. And so she winds up staying in a place called the Sisters of the Good Shepherd Home, which is a religious institution, a quasi-carceral religious institution for so-called fallen women. At the end of World War I, people are now able to be deported across the Atlantic. It winds up her name is not really Germaine Monet, it's Germaine Rigolou. She is from France, and she wound up being able to trick them, get herself 5 more years living in the US away from war, the war that was ravaging Europe. And kind of the argument that I make for her is that as a sex worker, she had some experience in giving men who are in positions of power just enough of what they wanted to satisfy them while being able to take some degree of agency and some degree of control for herself.
Stay tuned. When we come back from the music break, we will all return to Henry Wise's story as a culmination moment that brings Ethan's book full circle. Estamos de regreso. We are back to your podcast, UndocuTalks. Our guest and scholar, Ethan Blue, has been sharing stories from his book, The Deportation Express, a historical book on the building of the modern-day immigration system. Each story is filled with details about both immigrants caught in the messy web of the immigration system and those who built it. Henry Wise, who we began this episode with, was a former immigrant who eventually rose up the ranks within the immigration system to become the first chief deportation agent. I know, Wise is a hard figure to stomach, much like many of the characters who helped build the immigration system. But Ethan Blue reminds us that when you build a cruel system, that same system will not show compassion for anybody. Here's Ethan wrapping up his story through Wise.
Ending with Henry Wise. Yeah, Wise again is just this figure, and he's a tragic figure because...
Whoa, hold up a minute. Spoiler alert. We know some of our community has picked up Ethan Blue's book, The Deportation Express, to read alongside this episode, so we do not want to spoil the ending of the book. We're going to pause here. There will be a brief part two to this episode where we will share Ethan talking about the ending of the book for you to check out. So to end our interview with Ethan, here he is talking about intended audience for his book.
I really was trying to aim for a crossover audience. And so, I mean, I'm trained as an academic. And so most of my, it's a lot easier for me to write in academic language. And I think a lot of the theoretical stuff is really important and productive and useful. But at the same time, I'm hoping that the book is going to be reasonably accessible. As a writer, that was really tricky. The main body text is where I was writing for a general audience. The footnotes is kind of where I was writing for the more scholarly audiences. So that meant it was almost like writing two books at the same time, which was really, really quite difficult. Trying to make it accessible. I tried to make it as a generally accessible book to somebody who's interested. Hopefully you don't need to be, you know, to have some sort of advanced degree to read it and make some sense from it.
We hope that you have enjoyed our historical journey alongside our guest, Ethan Blue, in exploring the story of the modern-day immigration system. We would like to thank Ethan Blue for his generosity in sharing his time and expertise for this episode. Go out and check out his book, The Deportation Express, a must-have in your Andaki scholarship library. We will hear from a partner who we are excited to collaborate with. Check out their ad.
Hola, we are Delitas Apparel, an immigrant and Latinx clothing brand. We're two Latinas bringing you immigrant-inspired clothing from Tongvaland, aka Los Angeles. Our clothing company aims to inspire you to celebrate and be unapologetically yourself. In our shop, you will find shirts, stickers, tote bags, and anything you can think of. We are thrilled to partner with Andaki Talks for their season 4. We aim to collectively share our knowledge and lifestyles with our diverse communities. Stay tuned for our interview with Andaki Talks coming soon. You can follow us at Adelita's Apparel everywhere. And don't forget, stay unapologetic. Hi there, Jackson Yahaira again, coming to you from Adelita's Apparel. We will be joining forces with Undaka Talks to grow our DACA fund to support our immigrant community. What is DACA fund? Our DACA fund started because we wanted to give back to our community. We have supported about 60 individuals with their DACA renewal funds.
And we want you, the listener of this podcast who supports immigrant rights, to help us continue to grow our DACA fund. Please visit adelitasapparel.com to make a donation today. Additionally, proceeds from the purchases from our DACA fund collection also go to our DACA fund. So get your shop on while supporting our immigrant community. Again, visit adelitasapparel.com to learn more about our DACA fund and make a donation today. Hit that donate button and help us continue to thrive as Andaki baddies.
And we're inviting you, our community, to contribute to their ongoing DACA relief fund so that you can support our community members with funds to support their DACA renewals. We're getting to the end of season 4. You just heard an ad for our community partner, Adelita's Apparel. Go follow them on social media and check out their gear, because next month they'll be the focus of our featured episode. Stay tuned. Thank you. Gracias for listening to Undocu Talks. Stay tuned for our next episode. Meanwhile, you can find Undocu Talks on all major platforms. Remember to hit subscribe, like, share, and comment. And of course, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Undocu Talks. This was episode 4 for season 4 titled The Deportation Express. Our executive producer is Dr. Rafael Martinez. Our producer is Dr. Moises Santos. Our assistant producer is Froilan Orozco. Our fabulous scriptwriter is Dr. Melissa Garcia. Our Undocu News host is Alejandro Mendiaz Rivera. Again, my name's Elena, and it has been my pleasure serving as your host for this episode on Undocu Talks, La Voz de la Comunidad Inmigrante.